Thanks, Brother Chairman, and good evening, everyone. Well, if you thought Jonathan Bowen was fast, gird up your loins. We're going to condense what's normally a 4 or 5 night study into 45 minutes, or sort of. What we want to do, brethren and sisters, tonight is just to give you a bit of a glimpse at where humanism is coming from. I've got to say right at the outset, we're not going to have time to do what we would normally like to do with this, and that is to provide some of the practical advice and solutions, which obviously is the balance of the picture. But I think the important thing at the moment is to just make you aware of the philosophy of humanism, where it started, particularly what it is, and how you can detect it. I want to end up with a bit of a warning to us on the light of what Brother Jonathan has been saying to us, is that the churches around us have very much adopted this humanistic thinking that's been preached in the world for the last couple of hundred years. And that's a warning to the Ecclesia very much, that we mustn't go down the same track. Just a very quick thumbnail sketch initially of what humanism is. It's a word we have bandied around a lot, and some people really don't understand. Now, I'm going to give you some very precise definitions of humanism from the humanists themselves in a moment. But basically, this is what humanism is. I've reduced this down to the essential elements so we're all clear on what we're talking about. Humanism is a set of beliefs that starts with the premise that there is no God and no future for mankind. It says, secondly, that man is basically good. The good life, in other words, the pursuit of happiness in this life, is all that life is about. That men must be free to do whatsoever they like, providing they don't impinge on other people. And that reason is the supreme arbiter as to what is right or wrong. The outworking of that is that values and morals are subjective. In other words, whatever you think is right or whatever is right in your context is right. Self and indulgence are the primary things that you serve. You challenge and you fight everyone who has absolute values, and you tolerate almost anything. Now, that's my summation of humanism. Let me show to you from the humanists themselves exactly what they're about. Just a bit of background. I'm going to give you a couple of thousand years of history here in 10 seconds. Humanism started with the Greek philosophers, Plato, Aristotle, Socrates. Those men were the lovers of reason. That's what a philosopher is, a lover of reason. So they set their intelligent minds to try and work out the meaning of life. And they came up with the idea that there was no God, and even though the Greeks had many gods, they began to preach that human reason was the real authority in life. Not surprising to find that Socrates and Aristotle were the first two to set up schools and universities, because they saw the need to disseminate their views to other people. What then followed was that Greek philosophy was locked away after the fall of the Roman Empire. That was locked away over there in the east of the empire. With the invasion of the Muslims, all that knowledge and that Greek information was then driven westward at the same time, into Europe, at the same time that printing was invented. So they began in what was called the Renaissance, which means the Age of Enlightenment, which was really actually a grosser form of darkness. What actually happened was that all this stored up Greek philosophy arrived in Europe at the same time as the printing press. And so you had a rising in the 13th, 14th and 15th centuries, the rise of humanistic philosophy in Europe, and particularly in France, which was to lead to the French Revolution. And we could talk about men like Rousseau and Voltaire and other philosophers of the Age of Enlightenment, who were the men who actually set the world to think that there was a different way than to accept the authority of God. And human reason was that way. Now, those French philosophers began to have an impact on the world very early in the peace. And this is a document you'll all know very well, I'm sure, the American Declaration of Independence. And it was already riddled with this humanistic thinking that was coming from France. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men were created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inherent and inalienable rights. Now, I'll just emphasise the important words to humanists. All men are equal, inalienable rights, and among those are life, liberty or freedom, and the pursuit of happiness. Now, just remember those words when we come to humanistic thinking. Now, those sentiments in themselves probably sound quite noble, but bear in mind that this is coming from a background of rejecting divine authority and that man is now the arbiter of these things. The Bible had said these words, that at the same time as the Turkish Empire would be dried up, there would come three unclean spirits like frogs. In other words, a French-based philosophy. An unclean spirit is an attitude of madness. It says they are the spirits of demons, so they are attitudes of madness, says God. But they would be very powerful. They would work miracles. They would make dramatic and sudden changes in the earth. And they will go forth of the kings of the earth and of the whole world, and they would lead the world to Armageddon. So there's going to be in the world, says God, and this is Revelation 16. This is the chapter in which we find ourselves in the apocalypse. We are there in verse 15. Between verse 14 and 15 is where we stand. We know that the Turkish Empire was dried up, and we are now having the spirit of madness that's going to change the world so that God has to come and bring his judgments upon it. So there's going to be insane attitudes out there from the divine standpoint, which will emanate from the three frog-like spirits. And we know that those frog-like spirits are going to be in the mouth of the dragon and the false prophet and the beast. And we're going to have all the systems of Europe preaching these doctrines. Well, it came to pass in 1789. The three frog-like spirits asserted themselves. I want you to just notice that symbolic illustration of the French Revolution. I have a larger one here somewhere, which I'll show you in a moment. But what you've got here is this is how they represented the French Revolution. As we know, it was very largely a rising up of the people to overthrow the authority of the church. And with very good reason, because the church had oppressed the people in line with the aristocracy. But what happened was the people of France rose up, and I just want you to, you probably can't read these words, but it says this, and just think of this in scriptural terms, throwing aside every restraint. Proverbs 29 verse 18. The people of France repudiated all that pertained to God and glorified human reason. And the symbol of the French Revolution was a goddess, notice, a goddess of reason. There she is with a banner, raison, the French word. The goddess of reason. So that was what replaced the authority of the Bible. Now, that's how the French portrayed their revolution. And there's another portrayal of exactly the same thing. Throwing aside every restraint, the people of France repudiated the plan of God and glorified human reason. So there is the French Revolution. You now have the triumph of human reason over the authority of God. And that's what the French Revolution was all about. Well, what was the document that crystallized the French Revolution? The Declaration of Human Rights. So here is your doctrine of humanism now asserting itself in the world. And if you want a translation of that, I have it here. But the Declaration of Human Rights put in print all the things which the humanists and the philosophers of France had been preaching. Just read one of them to you. The nation is essentially the source of all sovereignty, nor can any individual or any body of men be entitled to any authority which is not expressly derived from the nation. So you see, authority now rests with the people. Fascinating, isn't it, that the Constitution of the United States starts off, we the people make these decrees. So you see, that's the spirit of the French Revolution. That's the unclean spirit like frogs that was to come from the mouth of the dragon, the mouth of the beast, and the mouth of the false prophet. And Brother Jonathan showed us this morning how even the false prophet system with the Second Vatican Council has begun to proclaim the frog-like spirit, Catholic socialism, Christian humanism. One of the headmasters of the leading Catholic school in Adelaide said in his closing address a couple of years ago, this Catholic school will continue on the basis of Christian humanism. So you see, they have adopted this because it's the popular policy in the world. A number of men have been responsible for the promotion of humanism in our times. And you might just notice this particular book, if you've ever seen that book, Seven Men Who Rule the World from the Grave, you can actually trace some of the main characters who've been responsible for the growth of humanism. We haven't got time to go into these, I'll just put them up. Charles Darwin, with his theory of evolution, enabled men to get rid of God as a creator. Karl Marx with his communistic socialistic theories. A most interesting character, if you've ever studied any of the philosophers, this guy was wonderful. Søren Kierkegaard. I just want you to notice what he gave as his own policy statement in life. I conceived it as my task to create difficulties everywhere. He was the man that began the principle, if you want to undermine any authority, any value, any absolute standard, you come up with all the tricky questions. And in our education systems, our children have been taught and educated that the way to devalue everything is to challenge everything by asking impossible questions of it. He invented the find yourself mentality. You are the centre of the universe. You've just got to find yourself. I could go on talking about that chap and some of his morality and his life, but he was one of the great thinkers who changed the world. Here's another one. This guy represented a whole school of what was called the higher critics, who around about 1880 to 1900 began to undermine the authority of the scriptures. This is why the Christadelphian movement had to take on the inspiration issue. Because men like Wellhausen and his companions were getting up and saying, the Bible is not accurate, the Bible is not totally inspired. And they began to say things like, well, Babylon's never been found. How can you say the Bible's inspired? Well, we know, of course, they were debunked many, many times later on. And so they began to undermine people's confidence in the Bible. And they came from within the church. So there is one of the problems that came. Then you have educators like Dewey, who was an American, and he brought in the fact that the religion must recognise the spiritual import of science and democracy. So he began to mix the education system with humanist thinking. There is no absolute truth, was Dewey's policy. And he represents a school of educators who began to do these things. And then, of course, we have our good friend Sigmund Freud, who began to talk about the different parts of the human mind. And basically, Freud was the one who brought in the idea that we're not responsible for our actions. I haven't got time to go into those. You can get more detail by finding that book. Let's just come down to humanism in their own words. Now, I want you to notice that these quotations they're putting up are the words of the humanists. It's not just me telling you what they're saying. This is what the humanists have as their statement of faith. And that is their statement of faith in four simple points. There's one thing that stands out to me from that document is that in three of those clauses, the good life is the ultimate objective of human existence. It's all about the pursuit of happiness, as the US Constitution says. And you see, what they've got to, they've got rid of God, they've got rid of the afterlife, and it's all about looking after number one now. That's the basic underlying philosophy of humanism. Now, they don't put it in such rude terms as that, but they start from foundations that are totally opposed to God. Man is not made to pray. The Bible says, in my flesh dwells no good thing. Paul said, I see a law in my members warring against the law of my mind. They say that man is basically good. The purpose of life is life on the earth, nothing after death. E.g., no judgment. You'll never be made to give an account for the things that you do. Man can sort out all the world's problems by reason and by experience. And the first and essential condition of the good life is liberty. The freeing of men's minds from ignorance and superstition and their bodies from the arbitrary oppression of the constituted social authorities, both political and religious. We don't want anybody telling us what to do. Now that's the basic statement of faith of the humanists. Let's just see some of how the further definitions are given to us. It's what they say about faith. They say the humanist is more than just an unbeliever. The consequences of his unbelief that man is alone in the universe without a God and without an afterlife. If man is to survive, he must accept responsibility for his own destiny. And by making full use, etc., etc. I won't be able to read all of these. You can read them for yourselves. But basically they say if a humanist is prepared to shoulder the consequences of his unbelief, he becomes personally responsible to the solution of the problems of mankind. And a lot of humanists are like this. They see that it's up to man to do something about solving the world's problems. Their attitude to the future, very clear. Promises of immortal salvation or fear of eternal damnation are both illusory and harmful. They distract humans from the present concerns, from self-actualization and from rectifying injustices. You see, one of the very dangerous things about humanism is that it talks about a lot of things that the kingdom is going to do. The kingdom will rectify injustices. The kingdom will solve the world's problems. So you see, many of their objectives are, what you might say, similar to what God intends to do with the earth. But it will not be through man and not through reason that those things will come. And the humanists often sound like they're preaching similar values to religion, but they're coming from a totally different standpoint. There is no evidence that life survives the death of the body. So, you see, they have no faith in the future. Now, remember what I said, three times the good life is what the basic plank of humanists have. I want to show you now how that particular concept has infiltrated into the thinking of society. We got an advert put in our letterbox the other day, trying to sell blocks of land. Live the good life, in grand style by the water. Or come to this department store and have the essentials for good living, you know, $1,000 bedspreads and $500 dinner sets. The essentials for good living. But you notice the phraseology that they're starting to use. How has that language come so much into our particular usage in this society? Well, the good old church haven't got away from it either. This is our Archbishop again. You know, this bloke's great for quotations. He's always putting his foot in it. But look at this. He said, you know, we're trying to work out why people aren't coming to church. Well, the church is seen as out of touch and opposed to the good life. Fascinating, isn't it? The church is seen to be out of touch and often opposite to what is thought to be the good life. And you see, the church is saying, well, you know, we're not preaching enough humanism. We're not giving people what they want in this life. We're not telling them to look after themselves enough. And he's finding that his church is out of touch with society. And they wonder why their churches are empty. Well, perhaps if they preached some good values, they wouldn't be empty. The Bible said this about the 21st century. And bear in mind, this is one of the few verses in the Bible that actually applies directly to our time. In the last days, dangerous times shall come. Men shall be lovers of their own selves. That'll be the primary quality of this age. Covetous, boasters, proud, etc. And all the other things we know that are in society. But number one was looking after yourself. And so we find we live in a society that recognises that this is the problem of life. They call themselves the me generation. That if you've got the motorbike and the car and the house and you're well set up with stocks and shares, you've made it in this life. And people today are selfish. People do not see themselves as giving for others. And even our paper was commenting on the fact that the baby boomers, our generation, are those who are the most selfish generation, who don't care about other people. We've been taught and educated that looking after number one is the most important thing. And the politicians have recognised this. You know, once there was a time when a politician got up and said, we're going to do this because it's good for the nation. It might cost you a few extra taxes, but it's good for the nation. And people would vote for that because the cause was right. Every politician today knows the only way to win an election is to get up and to say, I'm going to give you everything you want and not tax you to pay for it. Because they know that the votes, that people will vote today on the me factor. What's in it for me? And as a society, we've been taught by the humanists to look after number one. And so we find that this young fellow here has high principles. I'm a highly principled person. I live according to one principle. I never deviate from it. What's your principle? Well, look out for number one. And that is the spirit of humanism that's gone through our world today. So the good life and selfishness is encouraged. Again, humanists themselves, and we're quoting their own words, so we're not being unfair to them. Humanism is the effort of men to think and feel and to act for themselves and to abide by the logic of results. You see, human reason. No outside authority, what we think, what we deduce. So the method you use, you test things, and you carry it through. We disregard authority, habit, orthodoxy or religion, that's their code word for religion, are disregarded or defied. You ever wonder why your children might come home from school and start questioning everything you've said to them? Who said? Who are you to tell me what to do? And you see, they are being very, very subtly fed this idea that every set of authority needs to be defied. That's a basic humanist principle, is to challenge and to defy things that have been accepted. So you see, the question is, it's decided in the court of experience. You've got to try it for yourself. How can you say this or that is wrong until you've tried it? In the court of experience, that which is good is seen to satisfy the human test. Who cares what God thinks? So the humanist says that's how you define humanism. It's human reason, human experience that determines things. And we don't very much like religion as humanists, so they say this. Traditional religions often offer solace to humans, but as often they inhibit humans from helping themselves or experiencing their full potentialities. Too often traditional faith encourages dependence rather than independence. Well, they're dead right there. We can discover no divine purpose or providence for the human species. While there's much we do now know, humans are responsible for what we are and what we will become. No deity will save us, we must save ourselves. Now you're going to see in a moment how that works it out through our education system. But that's their attitude to religion. Their view of God? I believe the traditional dogmatic and authoritarian religions that place revelation, God, ritual or creed above human needs and experience do a disservice to the human species. We find insufficient evidence for belief in the existence of a supernatural. It is either meaningless or irrelevant to the question of survival and fulfilment of the human race. So very clearly, God goes out the window. They do not want to know any other source of authority. As a humanist, I am not coerced into sharing others' beliefs. My thoughts and actions are not determined for me by some organisation or authority. And this is another saying the same thing over and over again. But you see, they encourage different opinions. That's all, well, what you have to say is of equal value to what he has to say. And what do you have to say over there? Well, that's just of equal value. Well, everyone's got the right opinion. And we take on all opinions and we accept what we like, and the aim is that such actions be the result of reaching a consensus based on evidence, tolerance, and open to the need for constant modification. So humanist is very much a moving scenario. And you end up with people writing letters to the editor like this. This was written in response to the Moral Revival article I showed you the other day, but this person wrote in and said, and I picked up the spirit of humanism very clearly. Australia is not a Christian society, it is a secular society. As such, we have no absolute standard on which to base morality. Everyone's opinion is as good as anyone else's. Without the absolute standard our ancestors assumed, who's to say what is right or wrong, good or bad? And that's the sort of stuff that's being used not only as the basis of our politics and then the Acts of Parliament that are coming through, particularly in Australia, it's also the underpinning philosophy of our education system. Where it ends up is rather frightening. This particular quotation was one that I found absolutely astounding, not only for its perception, but for the clarity of where it puts the position. Now, Christ as a human personality is an enigma. But as a standard and pattern, there is no doubt or obscurity about him. He is the archetype, or the first example, of unqualified submission and obedience to the will of God, the God of Abraham, Isaac and Jacob. These are humanists speaking. They've looked at Jesus Christ, they've examined his writings and his sayings, and said, well look, he's the best example you will ever find of obedience to God. It is impossible to follow Christ on any other terms. It's a pity we couldn't see it that clearly sometimes. And the humanist finds acceptance of such terms a violation of himself and his whole experience. His rejection of Christ is therefore categorical. So don't think that humanists are accommodating of religion. They look at Christ and they say, well, we can never accept a man that accepts God as his master. They reject Christ categorically because there is no one that is the supreme example of what's right or wrong. There are many patterns of good living which can be exemplified, and none of them is best or comprehensively or exhaustively good. And that really tells you where the humanists are coming from. They reject Christ 100% because he is the best example of submission to the will of God. And that makes the issue, I think, abundantly clear of where we stand. Their ethics, well, they affirm that moral values derive their source from human experience. If it's good for you, if it feels good, do it. That's the humanist philosophy. Ethics are autonomous, and as they relate to the individual, situational. They can change from day to day, needing no theological or ideological sanction. You notice down here at the bottom? We strive for the good life, here and now. It's all about what we want to do for the maximum pleasure in this life. The goal is to pursue life's enrichment despite all these terrible forces of vulgarisation, commercialisation, and they love big words, bureaucratisation and dehumanisation, which is basically religion. And you can see where they're coming from. We want total freedom to do what we want to do. But there's some problems. I put this up just for you to have a look at. I thought it was quite amusing. You know, some of these cartoonists really have got the picture. He says, I don't believe in ethics anymore. As far as I'm concerned, the end justifies the means. Get what you can while the getting's good, which, that's what I say. Might makes right, the winners write the history books. It's a dog-eat-dog world, so I have to do whatever I have to do. Let the others argue about whether it's right or not. And then you get shoved in the mud. Why did you do that? You were in my way, now you're not. The end justifies the means. I don't mean for everyone, you dolt, just me. So, I mean, they can laugh at themselves, but it's serious. You see, that's the philosophy, isn't it? Look after number one. Don't have any ethics. But it has a few drawbacks. I want to just move on now to how it's taught. That's the full quotation. I showed the other day a partial quotation of this, but that's the full quotation. And the scary part about that is that the humanists back in 1983 declared war. And they declared war through our school system. Now in Australia, that battle was lost in a space of 10 years, particularly in South Australia and New South Wales initially. Two of our major states. The battle against humanism was very, very quickly lost. And our school system was taken over by people who think like that. I want you to notice, they see themselves as rabid preachers of a new faith. There was a deliberate campaign to get rid of headmasters who had Christian values. Teachers were forced not only to teach, but to give their acceptance to stuff that was being put out by feminists and by humanists, and by all kinds of immoral persons who found their way into the education system. But I want you to notice that they have seen the education system as the means of changing the next generation. I'll just read you a comment. This is from, in South Australia, we had an Act of Parliament for Sport and the Equal Opportunity Act. And we all know about equal opportunity, but they actually passed an act that dictated what would be done in schools with children's sport. And basically the act said this, is that every game that was played, there had to be equal numbers of girls and boys, and to address caste imbalances, the girls must win. So they had to umpire against the boys. And the whole objective was to teach kids that it didn't really matter who won anyway. So, you know, who's the winner? Winner? What's a winner? Brothers and sisters, always teach your children to strive for excellence in whatever they do. They should be striving for excellence. Not to beat other people, but strive to do your best in everything. But they took out the winning out of it. It's just fun. We're real playing, you know, we're just having a game, it doesn't matter really. And they took away from children this idea of winning. They said here, there is a need to liberate boys and girls from the stereotypes our culture applies to them. Now this particular policy in the schools was an outstanding failure, because the boys refused to play. And it really became quite a disaster. In fact, it's been quietly buried because it just was not practical. But the thing that's really critical about it is that they attempted by law to put that into our schools, to try and make the girls feel more confident. You know, I can show you the rest of this document if I haven't got it with me, but I could show it to you. It actually goes on to say that the only reason that girls are not physically capable of standing up to the boys in sport is all the decades that the girls have not been trained hard enough. And that was pure feminist equality. That if the girls were trained hard enough and made mentally tough enough, they could play every sport with the boys. You know, it was absolute insanity. But that was an act of parliament in South Australia to promote equality to our children. They realised, and as the preface of that book says, and this is what the Minister for Equal Opportunity said, she says, we realise that we can't change the values of the older generation quickly. But by starting in the schools, we can ensure the next generation have the right set of values. And that's what they set about doing. This is the methods they bring in. Now, if you hear of any of these terms in your children's education courses, get your antenna up very fast. These are the methods that are built into our education systems in Australia to teach humanism. Moral dilemmas, you know, all the stories that kids have put in front of them. You know, the ship's sinking, you're the captain, you've got one lifeboat, 10 spots in it. And here are 20 different people you can put in the boat, and you've got all the different classes of society and all different lifestyles, and you have to make a choice who goes into the boat. And then you've got to justify your choices to the class. And when it's all being done, you say, well, what was the right answer? And they say, well, there is no right answer. What we're doing is making you challenge your own values. And they do that by moral dilemmas, and there are some horrific examples of, and that was a very tame one, there are horrific examples in all areas of morality I could tell you about. And one of them, one in Australia, I won't go into the details because it's not fit in public, but when we asked at a Bible school how many kids had had this presented in their class, over 60% of the children had had this put to them. So you see, that's one of the things, the moral dilemmas. They also call it values clarification. What they mean is value challenging. They will say to the class, who here believes in that divorce is wrong, or who here believes in immorality or sexuality or something like that? They'll get a show of hands, and then they will challenge those values. And that's what they call values clarification. What it really does is to end the kids up not believing anything, believing that values are relative and situational. They put up all kinds of cases, like the history of the Eskimos in northern Canada, where the Eskimos, when it gets really cold winter, they kill the old people first and then the babies, because they need to preserve the little food there is. And so they say to the children, let's discuss this and see whether, is it right to kill people to save the tribe? And what they've done is to set one value against another value with the very objective of saying, well, values are relative. And you see, that's the kind of thing that goes on. Even the simplest things. In most schools, one of the greatest lessons that are taught to very young children is the life cycle of the salmon. Interesting study, isn't it? How a salmon can always find its way back to the very river that it was born in. And they give this whole wonderful story, and in our teaching manual, on the end of it, the teacher is told to make the point that this salmon does all these wonderful things without any direction from its parents. That's the moral of the story in our teaching manual. What do you think that message is getting through the little kid? You see, there are all kinds of things which might seem to be very innocent stories, but be very careful what's being put on the end of it. Moral biographies. We were wondering a few years ago why everybody was getting taught the story of Florence Nightingale. It was built into a lot of courses that were going through the education system. Well, she was only one of a number of characters they were studying, but when we went into it and said, well, why Florence Nightingale? You get hold of the teaching manual, and you have this wonderful story about this wonderful lady who saved so many lives and set up hospitals and brought in a whole new wave of nursing into the world. Fantastic person. But the punchline in the teaching manual is, to do that, she had to defy her parents, who didn't want her to be a nurse. So you see, if you do good to save humanity, defying your parents is quite okay. So they choose characters that have a story to tell. And very subtly, children's minds are unhinged from their parents' values. And we could go on talking about all these different courses. But here's a couple of comments from the teacher's manual, just to show you that this is the intent of what they're about. The tactic is to make people express their current values. The teacher challenges them but does not replace them with a whole new set of values, but just gives you almost nothing. But the idea is to undermine existing values. The great contribution of values clarification is its confrontation with the traditional and authoritarian approaches to moral education. That's where they're aiming at, to get at the morals and the values of our children. We hope through this course children will come to understand that what we regard as acceptable behaviour is a product of our culture. Now, when they openly put that in print, I think we have good cause to be alarmed. And I'm not saying your education system has gone as bad as ours has gone, but it's certainly gone down the tube in Australia. And so we find that innocuous subjects like health. Now, this is the health course that this boy is doing. And notice it says here, we are already tackling many equality issues at our schools through such subjects as health. What on earth has health got to do with equality? You see, the feminists have got into the course, and this boy is being taught how to do the ironing as part of his health subject. Now, I know some people perhaps were a little bit upset that I said that, you know, I referred to this, and some people thought perhaps I was saying that husbands should never help around the home. I think husbands should help around the home, just to make that extremely clear. What we're talking about is, society is trying to get our children to think that there is no difference between male and female, nor difference in their roles in the home and the ecclesia. There are very distinct differences we need to be aware of. They are setting about trying to convince our boys and our girls that they are all equal and that everything, all their roles, ought to be interchangeable. And so as it says there, shouldn't be doing his homework. That is his homework. So you can see how that even at that age, the basis of what they are doing is not only being concealed under a subject like health, and I could give you lots of other examples like that that are put under health, but the object is to teach feminist values. The humanists believe that man has to solve the problems of the world for themselves. Men face together the common problems of mankind. All the evils have to be sorted out by man. So that's the humanist value, that we have to solve the world's problems. But they put that burden on our children. Have you ever noticed how your children these days are much more environmentally conscious? At our young folks gathering in recent years, when we have a bonfire after some of our activities, I have young people telling me off, hey, so someone threw a plastic cup on that fire. In my time, we would have burnt tyres and everything. But, you know, we have young people coming to us very conscious about the environment. Now, I'm not saying we should deliberately pollute the environment. What I'm saying to you is that they have been made very conscientious because upon them, the humanists have put the responsibility. Just an example of that. We had a Sunday school recently and someone said to the teachers, how can we please God? Oh, by saving the whales, a little child said. So you can see that the humanists have got this message across. Children are being taught, and this is a Christadelphian comment, by the way, in the top here. Children are being taught with the best of motives that often by concerned and caring people that it's up to us to save our world. The humanist approach is taken as axiomatic, in other words, it's taken as what we ought to be. And here's a couple of quotations from books that are used in schools. In the volume, The Greenhouse Effect, children are told it is vital to all of us that we fully understand the complex relationship between the atmosphere and the earth. Now, that might seem an innocuous statement, but the burden is being put upon children to solve the world's problems. How green are you? The title page invites children to use the Friendly Whales Action Plan to make the earth a better place for us all. On the back cover it asks, can you help to save the world? Yes, you can. If you're 6 years old or more, you can save energy, protect wildlife, join in, etc., etc. The book ends up by saying, now it's up to you. So you see, the idea of the humanists being those who will save the earth is being passed on to our children. Well, it's having an impact in our schools. In Australia, we're starting to see now a crisis amongst boys. Because of the pressure of the feminist movement in our schools, they're starting to find that the results of the boys in school are nosediving, and so is the participation. And what we're having in Australia, which is just being now recognised, is that we're having an incredible increase in suicide amongst boys. Because they no longer find what their place is in society. They've been told to sit in the corner and shut up and let the girls have a go. And we're having very much in Australia a problem with the nation's boys. The sad thing about that, brethren and sisters, is that that's being reflected in the ecclesias. 2 years ago, I was at a school of the prophets in which we have about 35 young lads spend a whole week around the Bible with some senior brethren present. In the question session, after we'd been there all week exhorting them to, you know, become leaders in our young folks group, in the question session we had three or four questions put to the senior brethren along the lines, why are you asking us to be leaders? We don't want to be leaders. And I think that's really, really sad. That these boys have got the idea that it was not cool for them to get up and to show the way. And it's actually in Australia a culture that the people who get up and say, this is the way, walkie in it, are pulled down because humanism has taught people that we're all equal, my opinion's as good as yours, and who do you think you are to tell me what to do? And we've got to be very cautious about that attitude coming through into our boys. Just be conscious that even the toy makers are promoting the values of liberty and freedom. And even the toys nowadays are reflecting the gay community. When you get into the workplace, this is the kind of stuff that gets delivered around on my desk every so often. You've got rights. And one of those rights, most interestingly, is to make mistakes. You know, I go to my staff and say, why did you do this? Well, I have a right to make a mistake. And you see, humanists to say, well, I've got to be treated with respect. I have a right to express my own feelings, to be listened to and taken seriously. My opinion is as good as yours. And so people are encouraged to press for their rights. We have this sort of stuff put around, the Equal Opportunity Act, where you can't criticise any lifestyle. I don't need to make any comment on those things. You get the message pretty clearly. But this is the kind of stuff that's trumped around the workplace to tell us that we have to accept these values that society has now adopted. Some of you might have been through this in your business culture. The self-empowerment phase. When you don't have management, you don't have managers anymore telling you what to do. You have little teams that work it out for themselves and they experiment with everything. So, you know, it's all about self-discovery. The expression through our actions, or personal choices we can make in the workplace. Value of what we value in our relationship with the clients and the customers. And so the troops are telling the managers how the place will be run. And we have the right to make mistakes. You know, it's amazing how the values are being turned upside down. I want to just say something about the feminist movement very quickly. That statement you've probably seen before. It was made at the International Women's Congress in 1975, and at the time it was a source of utmost derision throughout the world. People couldn't stop laughing at that suggestion. I just say to you this, who's laughing now? That was their objective that they set out in the International Women's Year in 1975. Haven't they been successful? You know, we have in Australia a system whereby mothers are paid by the government to put their children into childcare. We have this sort of stuff being in our papers. Almost every day of the week, our local paper in Adelaide pumps out some of this kind of stuff, saying that women have to learn to be not only exercising their rights, but to exercise their equality in the workplace. Getting over the old values. Men should be sharing the load. And so it goes on. When girl power is business, etc., etc. And so we find that the feminist movement is having quite an impact. There's a whole new language in most workplaces in Australia. You know, you can't talk about... I'm not allowed to write any document or letter that refers to anyone's gender. So everything you write, whether it be any paper or submission, has got to be gender-free. And so we talk about persons and chairpersons and all things like that. And you can see there that they're not even willing to accept the man-made disaster. Let the men have that one. And the whole language has actually been changed by law. So you cannot refer to anything which is of gender. And we have this thing that you can't talk of anyone as being disadvantaged. You can't say anything. We were actually told to say that, because I deal with people who have been injured at work, and we weren't allowed to call them disabled. We were told to call them challenged. But now that's not even correct. And they're now just clients. You're not allowed to make any reference to their disabilities. And so this fellow says, I'm too old. No, you're chronologically impaired. There's some of us vertically challenged, some of us are horizontally challenged. And me, I'm follically challenged. So, you know, it's all about the new language we're expected to talk about. The result of society, the result of the feminist movement, is we have this problem. All these childcare mums who feel guilty because they're not with their children. And, you know, that's something society has imposed upon us. And you end up with this scenario where you've got career women. And, you know, she says exactly the same thing as one of those previous articles said. We were brought up in our schools to believe that we could have anything and we could be anything we wanted to be. The cost, she says, is you can't have children. And so she's decided she's not going to have children. And this is the kind of stuff that's printed in the paper. Every day of the week there's something like this to try and change society's thinking that this is a good thing. So we find that that motherhood is losing its appeal for women. They're finding if you go out and you stop to have a baby, then you lose the race in the climb up the corporate ladder. So feminism is a great problem that's being pumped to us in our schools, our media and our workplaces. Getting back to this matter of individuality, the right to be what I please, and you can see there that the precious of the individual is what matters to the humanist. We says there, we reject all moral codes that denigrate the individual, suppress freedom, etc., etc. So they want maximum liberty to do what you like. This is a page from a training manual from the workplace. People aren't wrong, they're just different. It's the kind of stuff that we're expected to accept, and the kind of stuff I might say to you that's being very much picked up very, very subtly by many of our young people. You've already seen that one, that in regard to sexuality, they hate intolerant attitudes. and so we're expected. And what is really tragic, brethren and sisters, is to see that the church is following that line. And as we pointed out, those who object and have moral values in this area are told that they're the ones with the problem. And so we find that our church is re-examining the scriptures to try and find out, to see if God made a mistake in Romans chapter 1 and in Genesis chapter 19 about Sodom and Gomorrah. And they say to people, and I just find this so staggering, he hints that the church may not yet have fully enough analysed the scriptures concerning homosexuals. I don't know how many times you can read Romans chapter 1 and you can't make it mean anything else. But they keep saying it, and these men have had the Bible in their hands for hundreds of years and they still can't read Romans chapter 1. And they keep giving people the hope that one day they'll find a way to get rid of the Bible. And so we now have a new top cleric, the new head of the Church of England, which is the largest church in Australia. The new head of the Church of England in Australia is actually a man who doesn't believe that it's only through the Christian faith that you're saved. He believes, he said the belief that salvation could only come through Christ was not valid in a modern, multicultural context and arose because the gospel writers were unaware of religions such as Buddhism and Islam. Now there's a broad church if you ever saw it. He's really saying, well, you know, you can serve God in whatever way you like and you'll still come to salvation. And what I'm trying to point out from this is that the church has been sucked in 100% by humanist thinking. And so you get that kind of thing. Sponsored by the Methodist Church. You see how they've lost their values? They declare their sin as Sodom, said the Bible. And so they do. That's sponsored by the Adelaide Central Mission, which is an arm of the Methodist Church in Australia. The churches, brethren and sisters, have caved in to humanism. New Reformation sweeping Christianity, women taking over in the church. And again, they are re-examining the scriptures. Perhaps Jesus made a mistake in only picking men for his apostles. And they're trying to get rid of Paul because Paul is so clear on the position of women in the ecclesia. The Bible says that God decreed that following what happened in Genesis, and because Eve was not first created, she should have been listening. And because Adam was first created, he should have been doing the talking. And because Adam listened and Eve talked, God put a law in place that said, when you come into worship, I want the man to do the talking and the woman to do the listening. And I want that respected. And through the apostles, he said, I suffer not a woman to speak in the ecclesia. I will, says Paul, that men pray everywhere and that women contribute to the meeting by not distracting the men through improper clothing. You can't get any clearer than those two passages, brethren and sisters. Why in the last 20 years has the Brotherhood been subjected to a campaign that says we want women to be speakers, to be chairpersons, to take on public office in ecclesial meetings? Why is it even a question in our midst? Because the feminist movement has pushed governments around, education systems around, the churches around, and they're trying to do it to us, subtly. People are accepting that philosophy as being a wise one. Human reason has taken over from divine law. And they're trying to work out why the churches are empty. English churches faced with doom. The Christian church will be finished in England in 40 years if its decline is not halted. They think by giving the people what they want, they'll bring them back to the church. The opposite is the case. People don't respect the church that has given up its values. And again, our good old Archbishop in Australia, you tell me whether or not the humanists have got to him. Adelaide's Anglican Archbishop has rejected the notion that the Bible was literally the Word of God. Now, this is not some clergyman out in the boondocks. This is the Archbishop of Adelaide. And he says the Bible was in some way the gift of God. And he talks about these terribly weak-minded people called fundamentalists That's us, brethren and sisters. Proud fundamentalists. Thus says the Lord. He said fundamentalists held the view that God only speaks through the scriptures and has spoken once and for all. What simple people they are. Now, I want you to bear in mind, this is the archbishop. You tell me whether or not the humanists have got to him. He gives little attention to intuition or the importance of seeing the role of the God-given intelligence in interpreting scripture. The true Anglicanism, he says, I believe, is committed to a balance of reason, tradition and scripture. Fundamentalism leaves reason out, and just as well it does, because in the flesh dwells no good thing. The natural thinking has to be destroyed. The carnal mind is enmity against God. It is not subject to the law of God, and it cannot be. Brethren and sisters, let's not go down the road of doubting the authority and the veracity of scriptures. God's values do not change. He says, woe to those that call evil good and good evil, that put darkness for light, that turn all the values of God upside down, that are wise in their own eyes and prudent in their own sight, that replace God's law with human reason. We, brethren and sisters, have got a fight on our hands. They have declared war on us. We've got to fight. We've got to wrestle against spiritual wickedness in high places and to take upon the weapons of warfare that we have. And the weapons we've got that demolish arguments and all the pretensions that set themselves up against God, of course, is the Word. The weapons we fight with are the weapons of understanding and knowing and being clear about what the Word of God actually says on these issues. I want to just conclude with a quotation from an article in The Bible Student, which I think summarises the position and the challenge brilliantly. The humanist philosophy appeals to the vanity of the natural man, and its freedom of thought encourages its tentacles to spread far and wide into corners that can sometimes take us by surprise. Very often people find themselves in the humanist position without deliberately having taken that stance. Let me say to you that you will never have somebody come to you and say, I'm here to preach humanism. They never attack from the front. They come along and they just infiltrate everywhere. In fact, they may be in humanist tradition without ever subscribe their minds to the basic, man is on his own and this life is all there is policy. We must seriously ask ourselves whether we as Christadelphians have not been so busy warding off church giants that we have failed to notice that offensive little man, always with us, who seems to be so reasonable and so charming. And the problem with humanism is that it appeals to the human mind. It says, you are cleverer than God. We have to be so careful, brethren and sisters, of this philosophy and in all its manifestations, and to make sure we now are very, very clear on what God's values really are. Thanks for your patience, and I'm sorry that was such a rush.